Back together again with you for a busy show. Thursday, September 14th, 2023 on Connecticut Today. We chatted with Quinnipiac University law professor Sheila Hare on the latest legal ruling regarding the controversial DACA program and its possible effect on about 11,000 undocumented migrants in Connecticut. Landmark Legal Foundation attorney Mike O'Neill back with the program. He talked about the theory behind an impeachment push by House Republicans. And once again, only in Bridgeport, blogger Lenny Grimaldi updated the Bridgeport mayoral race. Now let's welcome an actual legal authority to the show. Somebody who does actively teach law, Quinnipiac University School of Law, Professor Sheila Hare is going to join us to talk about, yet again, I'm losing contact here, losing count, rather, and contact for that matter, of how many rulings we've had on the DACA program. Now, there are about 600,000 DACA recipients in the U.S., and in Connecticut, about 11,000 DACA recipients. Another federal judge has said no, the way this was put together was not legal. So to talk about this once again, Professor Sheila Hare, Quinnipiac University School of Law. We've had her on before. Professor, hi, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on this important issue.
Yeah, so let's talk about this, Professor. And this is kind of a metronome. We go one side, then the other, pick a judge, one side, pick another judge. So let's talk about, and I know a lot of people may know about this, Professor, but some may not. Describe what the DACA program is and what's the controversy here.
Well, it is the DACA, stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and it essentially is a program started by the Obama administration back in 2012, and it's aimed at kids, and now young people in their 30s, some of them, who came over the border without permission because their parents essentially brought them through no choice of their own. And these young people, if you've ever met any of them, and I encourage you, if you know any, to sort of speak to them to the extent that they feel comfortable, most of them will tell you they don't know the home country that they came from. I had a law student who came as a six-month-old in the arms of her mother crossing the border. Mm-hmm. She was the oldest child. She arrived here. All her brothers and sisters are younger. They're all U.S. citizens. And so this is the kind of kid. And what we found out, there was a Supreme Court case back in 1982 in my home state of Texas, and the Supreme Court said that we cannot keep these children from being educated here in this country. And what Obama found was in 2012, these kids wanted to go to college, they wanted to support themselves, they wanted to pay taxes, and this was the only country they knew. So this was a way to give them sort of temporary, and I wouldn't say status, it's not legal status, but it's a sort of temporary non-status that allows them to be here and work and contribute to their upkeep and advance our country's economy.
Professor, as I've been, and please, you're the expert on this, not me, but some of these rulings, I read a summary of the latest one that came out from this current judge who was given this to decide, and others in the past. Professor, am I correct in saying it's not so much what the DACA program is intended to do? This sounds like a process issue of how it was set up, who did have purvey over this, and who didn't, kind of in the weeds here in the federal process. Is that right or not?
That's essentially it. I think that's a fair characterization. And the issues get very complicated, but there have been some various administrative questions that have been raised. And it's funny, you said, you know, there's been a lot of cases. That is absolutely true. What's funny, there haven't been as many judges because Judge Hainan from Texas has actually been on cases similar to this. So mm-hmm. Most people, for better or for worse, were expecting this outcome. And unfortunately, I think we're going to see the case go up to the Fifth Circuit and then eventually the Supreme Court. And I think essentially you've hit the nail on the head because there's questions about whether this program was legally promulgated. I mean, I think what it screams to me is the need for Congress to step in and act and make sure that we aren't playing yo-yo with people's lives. So, you know, I can say that we We have 74% of Americans supporting giving some form of legal status to these young people. And, you know, when I picture these individuals, you know, they work as hospitality workers, construction, mm-hmm. social services, my gosh, teachers, we're talking about teachers, pharmacy techs, my gosh, medical assistants. Think about what condition our healthcare system is in right now post-COVID. Essentially, this ruling, it says that we are putting in jeopardy these jobs, the employers that employ these young people, and frankly, our country's economic stability. So I think you're right. We've been playing yo-yo, and it's time. I think the solution is to let Congress act. If Congress acts, I think everybody agrees it's clearly within the authority of Congress to pass legislation. You know, people call it the Dream Act, but yeah. some sort of legislation that addresses this problem. Absolutely.
Quinnipiac University Law Professor Sheila Hare on, again, the latest kind of speed bump in finally maybe getting some resolution to these 600,000 or so folks in the country from, you know, teens. Little kids all the way up to people in their 30s, about 12,000 of whom are in Connecticut here. You know, Professor, I always say on things like this, and I tend to be somewhat of a hardliner on immigration, but in general, on issues like this, I always say if you got members of Congress away from the microphones into a room where they could be anonymous and not go on the record and not worry about either side screaming or yelling at them because you did this and you didn't do that, I would bet you 98% of them could hammer out some sort of a reasonable compromise on this, probably in about 15 minutes. But I honestly think that there is so much fear from both sides as to don't you dare agree to that or don't you dare agree to that, that this is why we tend to stay in this vapor lock on not only issues like this, but other issues as well.
Well, I have to say, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the number 74% is a little bit low. I think it's even higher than that. And you're in that number, as am I. And we can disagree about our immigration policies and say that the immigration system is broke. But I think, frankly, this is a no-brainer. And I hope that people will say, let's end this deadlock and really push our legislators to come up with a solution. Because if you've met some of these kids, you know, I have a student who's a lawyer right now. Mm. And, you know, what is she going to tell her employer and her client? And kind of what uncertainty. I don't think we would tolerate this kind of uncertainty for anybody. And frankly, you probably don't know all the DACA kids that are actually maybe of your acquaintance because they blend in with the rest of us. These kids are as American as I am, right? And I was born here in this country. So I couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely.
Quinnipiac University Law Professor Sheila Hare. Professor, thank you. Great to chat with you again. And I'm sure as this issue advances down the road, we'll talk again. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your interest in this issue. Have a wonderful day.
Appreciate it. Quinnipiac University Law Professor Sheila Hare. Now, you have to understand something, folks. Before you start calling me up and blowing my head up about, they're illegals. No, you have to understand something. These are not people that are adults that came here willingly. The people that the 600,000 or so in the country, in the 11,000 or so here in Connecticut, they came to the country because their parents brought them here. They didn't have a choice in the matter. It's not like they were of age and said, hey, I'm going to make a purposeful effort to violate the border of the United States. That's not who we're talking about here. As Professor Hare just said, some of these kids come over as infants. And she said right now she has a former student of hers who's a practicing attorney. Now, was it that attorney's fault that mom or dad or grandma or grandpa gave them no choice but to come to the U.S.? And you're going to send those kids back? Come on. That's ridiculous. I'm as conservative as the next guy, but let's get our heads out of our rear on this, please. Good Lord. All right, back to open phones next hour. When we do that, we will, of course, be at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Now, you're probably wondering, hey, what is up with this impeachment thing of Biden? What's Kevin McCarthy doing? Is this just, a piece of raw meat to the conservatives in his caucus? Why do you need an impeachment inquiry here? What's the end game here legally? Mike O'Neill, one of our legal eagles, joins us from the Landmark Legal Foundation to talk about this. Mike, good to speak with you. Good to have you back here as we get into the fall. How are you?
Good. Good to be with you, Paul.
So, Mike, explain this to my listeners here. What is going on here, okay, and how does this tie in to people saying, well, you know, even though there's zero chance the Senate would ever vote to impeach, this does serve a purpose. Lay this out for us.
Right. So this is an impeachment inquiry. This isn't an impeachment vote. This is the initial step, which elevates the current investigations. There are several House committees, House of Representative committees, who are investigating the entire Hunter Biden, Joe Biden matter, all of Hunter Biden's malfeasance, his tax avoidance, all of his purported crimes or alleged crimes. These House committees have been doing the yeoman's work. They've been really picking up where the Department of Justice has dropped the ball. And for the most part, the media has really dropped the ball on this. So they've had witnesses testify, Devin Archer, which was Hunter Biden's former business partner. Mm-hmm. They had IRS whistleblowers testify. And so they've gathered some significant evidence. But what this does, the impeachment inquiry, is it elevates the authority of those committees. It elevates the authority of the committees to subpoena records, to subpoena bank records, to subpoena records from other agencies, the Department of Justice, for example. It also gives them the power to call witnesses and to essentially gather facts and evidence to determine whether articles of impeachment are justified. And they will make a decision after conducting an investigation. So this is a fact and evidence gathering process by a larger body of the House of Representatives with a larger profile and more authority.
Mike, did I hear correctly a couple of days ago or read correctly that, for example, because this has now been elevated to that level that you outlined to us here, that now allows or would mandate that certain documents which had redactions in them now can no longer be redacted? Is that right?
That might be a legal technical question. I'm a little nervous on giving a definitive answer. I would assume that possibly, but again, that might be a dispute. You might have a dispute between the two branches, right? You might have the congressional committee saying we need these unredacted, and then the executive branch or the person asserting the redaction saying, well, no, these are privileged in some manner. So I think it would have to be on a case. Again, me speaking extemporaneously on that particular issue, it would probably be on a case-by-case basis, and it might be subject to some sort of – I'm not sure, but I will say, though, definitively that there is an enhanced power. There is an enhanced subpoena power. They do have more authority. So I think I can't weigh in definitively, but I think that sounds about right.
Now, Mike, and you mentioned Hunter Biden, and there's a million ways this web spins here. Now, obviously, you know what happened today with the indictment on the gun charges, which, you know, a couple of months ago, that wasn't even talked about. Now we've done a complete 180 in this. Mike, and educate my uneducated legal mind here. Is there any sort of a possibility that Hunter Biden, because you tell me whether this is possible or not, where he could cut some sort of a deal on some of this if he talks more regarding some of these business dealings? And listen, I'm not saying throw his father under the bus. I don't think of any son or daughter that would do that. But is there a connection to any of this, Mike, do you think, or not?
We had a plea agreement. There was a purported plea agreement that blew up a couple. I think now it's a month or two ago. Mm-hmm. Now the time goes so fast. So I don't see that in the cards. I don't see him cutting a plea agreement right now. I think he's going to face this gun charge again. And the question remains there on that is whether this is an effort to kind of, submarine or torpedo some of the larger investigations, some of the larger questions which implicate the president. And again, I think that we really need to focus on the ball here. The Hunter Biden gun charge is one thing, right? But what's really important to the American people is the extent to which the president of the United States has played a role in this. Whatever his son did is one thing. And again, going back to it, there are enough facts that have been pretty much established that justify an inquiry. I mean, you have $20 million, you have shell companies, you have a text that Hunter Biden sent to his sister stating that he had to have 50% of his income to pop, meaning his father. You have dinners where Biden as vice president was in Georgetown with these Russian oligarchs. You have Biden you know, President Biden, Vice President Biden dropping in on phone calls. You have all kinds of evidence to support this inquiry. And I don't see him, I don't see Hunter Biden cutting a deal where he would somehow implicate his father. Again, Hunter Biden is facing criminal charges, and his father right now is facing political, you know, a political process. The impeachment process is political, and, you know, the criminal process is a lot more grave from that standpoint.
Sure. Mike, there was also a story in this, you may remember, boy, about a week or two ago, that actually had legs for a few days of the National Archives. Did I read, Mike, supposedly having emails where the president was using aliases? Yeah. And what is the procedure or the pushback that could happen if this congressional committee says, hey, we want to see all these emails unredacted? Right. Can they have the power to do that? Can the National Archives fight that? What's the deal with that?
I think they would. Again, that specific inquiry, I would think that they would have the ability to look at those within the context of, I mean, you could negotiate some sort of disclosure of those where the committee members or Congress, they limit it to the individuals, you know, it'd be the equivalent of an in-camera examination, where the actual members of the inquiry board, the House representatives, would be able to look at those records unredacted. Yeah, and that's another piece of evidence that I didn't mention in my litany of it. Again, the use of email, you know, the use of alias email, nom de plumes for Biden. Again, all of this support, I think the American people really are being psyoped by, I guess, you know, you have obviously the Democrat supporters, but then you have certain members of the legal establishment saying that there's not enough evidence to support an inquiry. And again, what we're talking about here is an impeachment inquiry. This isn't like the, you know, lightning fast impeachments of Donald Trump, where there was an impeachment and then there was a vote a couple weeks later. Look, this is an inquiry that's going to be systemic. They're going to follow the evidence where it leads. There's not a time limit on this. There's not an accelerated process. They're going to gather evidence and facts, and they're going to muster a case to determine whether the House of Representatives can justify articles of impeachment and put that to a vote for the entire House majority vote. And then, of course, if there's a majority supporting those articles of impeachment to impeach the president, it kicks over to the Senate for the trial.
And finally, Mike O'Neill, it doesn't sound like, at least at this point, the vibe from the Senate, I don't know, you know, maybe they're laying low here, but no, it certainly doesn't sound like they have the appetite for this, or maybe they're just playing it cool.
Well, no, I don't think so. Again, 2/3 is a very high bar. But what is important here is that there's a full airing of the facts. Again, just to compare Donald Trump's activities, we know everything. Donald Trump is facing multiple criminal indictments, multiple investigation on top of investigation. We know what he was signing, you know, thanks to the New York trial. We know that what records he was signing back when he was the chairman of the Trump Organization. But what we don't know is the extent to which, on the other side of the ledger, that President Biden, the role he played in all of his son's nefarious, allegedly criminal, apparently criminal activities. And so I think, you know, just on balancing, you want to see the role that Biden has played in this and whether it's, you know, going into next year, going to the election, so that the American people can serve as judge and jury of all of this.
All right. It's Landmark Legal Foundation, landmarklegal.org. Our guy there who is with us. And boy, Mike, can't wait for the Supreme Court docket this fall. That's going to be fun, too. Mike O'Neill is the guest. Mike, thank you. And we'll chat with you down the road, sir. Thanks. All right. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate that. Aw, yippee. Ain't you lucky, lucky? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. We'll get back to open phones. Last half hour of the program. 203-333-9422. When we do that, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Yet another update. We put him on extra duty this week. I filled out the papers for the OT pay. Lenny Grimaldi's with us, only in Bridgeport.com. Lenny, how you holding out, pal? You okay with all this excitement?
I'm holding out, Uncle Paulie, for extra absentee ballots.
There you go. All right. So, Lenny, give us the update here. By the way, you're breaking up a little bit, so if you can move around and solidify that signal. Now, you texted me earlier, and again, another interesting twist and turn, Lenny. We thought it was, what, a 500-plus vote margin yesterday. It's a lot lower than that. What's going on?
So, it's now official. Mayor Joe Gannon has defeated his opponent, John Gomes, by 251 votes. That is the official certified number, and it's done. So whether John Gomes challenges or not, we'll wait to see. So to get back to your point about the fluctuation, the variations in the number, so I looked into this, and here's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
In a couple of the precincts, the results were inverted. So in a couple of precincts initially that Gomes had won, they recorded those numbers for Ganim and then realized it was a mistake.
Oops.
And that's why when I write these stories ad nauseum, I mean, I drive people crazy because I write unofficial.
Yeah.
In the days after the vote, you're going to have these little fluctuations, these changes, these nuances. And so that's why you had, on primary night, we had one number, the next day we had another, and the next day we had another. And then they go, oh, let's go back and look at all of the returns. And what really matters is the tape that comes out of the voting machine.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have to go by. And they went back and revisited all the numbers on the tapes that came out of the machines. And the final number, adding up all of the in-walk vote, and the absentee ballots, total, it gives Joe Ganim a 251 vote margin.
So now, Lenny, you and I had talked about it, and we've talked about this before. When a judge looks at something, we don't know whether Mr. Gomes is going to go on the legal route or not. That remains to be seen. But you talked yesterday with me about the fact that, even if there is allegedly some funny business, it's got to be, the number has got to be there, right? Where a judge, as you said, says, well, okay, this is low enough that it could have really affected it. So we were at 500 and change, and now we're at 250. Does that change things, you think, or not?
No, because you still need 251 reasons.
Yeah, okay.
And that's threshold, 251 reasons. If you're a couple of votes, if you're 5 votes, if you're under 10 votes, even say 20, you might make an argument to a judge and say, hey, this is it's a fuzzy area, and just order a new vote so we can clean it up. But this number is really, really high, and judges they don't really want to get involved, because when a judge overturns something, understand that you're disenfranchising a lot of people who mm-hmm. voted the right way.
Yeah.
He went in saying, I just wanted to go vote. I wanted to fill out my absentee clean. I wanted to vote, go into the voting booth and just, fill out my form clean. And now you're saying that you ain't going to come back because of a bunch of people here. So judges are really, really reluctant to overturn something, especially if it's someone like Barry Stevens, right? Who oversaw the challenge of the 2019 mayoral primary in which Joe Gannon won 270 votes. This is 251.
Mm-hmm.
Barry Stevens is not chasing down a train. I mean, this is a man who is very thoughtful and deliberative. He's got to take his time. So if you're John Gomes and saying, let's make a play in court, understand it really sucks the oxygen out of you. It's expensive. It's time-consuming. It takes a lot of time, and these things, if there's a court challenge, it's not a week. You're talking about a 4 to 5 week process deep into October when you could be, so John Gomes has a ballot line in November. It's not like he doesn't have a ballot line. Now, if he didn't have a ballot line in November, I could see.
Sure.
We got nothing to lose. Let's roll the dice. But he does have a ballot line on the Bridgeport Independent Party line. It's his. It's his. So his choice is, do we run into court? What are our chances? Or do we say, hey, let's just hit the pavement again.
Sure.
Try to take it to the people. And my guess is, I don't know, I haven't talked to John about what he's going to do. My guess is in the end, he probably just says, hey, this court challenge is really too much to take on. That's a guess. I don't really know. Something can change. They're probably looking around for some information and trying to make a compelling case. But, in the end, this absentee ballot thing is what happens is when you lose, you look for excuses.
Yeah.
That's human nature, right? And both sides play it. And And here's where we are. We began with a certified 251 vote win, and we'll see if John just says, hey, we'll take it straight to the general election and make my case there.
Yeah, and he's getting, you know, listen, it's being covered by us here and on the TV outlets and your blog and obviously in Hearst. He did say something interesting, John Gomes. Letty Grimaldi, of course, is the guest right here on WICC. In one of the paragraphs here of his statement that you posted, Lenny, quote, despite campaign staffers and challenge candidates being threatened, unquote. What does he mean by that?
A shtick.
Okay.
Here's his evidence. I mean, here's the problem with John going there, and I've written about this. The only person who's under active investigation right now, potential absentee ballot fraud, is his supporter, City Council member Maria Pereira, who went into a 81-year-old woman's house with her not being there, looking for an absentee ballot, and was caught on film. The local police are looking at this. So that's the trick. When you make this big hullabaloo about losing an absentee ballot, his own supporter is undercutting his own narrative. So be very careful about this stuff.
Finally, Lenny, let me ask you this. I know you've been making calls and talking to people over the last two or three days. Can you tell my audience here, Lenny, and tell me maybe one or two things you heard? Don't mention any names. Don't do that, because I generally get in enough trouble as it is. One or two things, Lenny, you may have heard that maybe made you go, wow, that's interesting, or not. Was this pretty run-of-the-mill?
So far, I think it's run-of-the-mill. Both sides worked the absentee ballots. You know, Mayor Joe Ganim's operation came up with a lot. John Gomes came up with a lot. And we talked yesterday. The absentee ballots that that went for John Gomes' way, more than 800 of them, the third largest absentee ballot turnout for a candidate in a Democratic primary in history.
That's a lot.
Now, it's a lot. So Ganim had a little over 900 4 years ago, and Gomes had, you know, more than 800, and the Mayor Joe Ganim's operation had more than 1,500. So, you know, it's a funny thing, and I wrote a story about it, and some of my, all of Gomes' friends got on top of me. You know, when John Gomes was on the payroll working for Joe Ganim 4 years ago, I caught him going inside Testo's restaurant. I said, John, what do you think? He said, we got insurance. If we lose on the machines, we've got the absentee ballots going our way. This was John Gomes.
Right.
And then he lit up a cigar, you know, you know, making his $130,000 a year on the public payroll. Then he had a falling out with the mayor. So people, for me, I find this kind of amusing, the whole thing. And so now John Gomes is the candidate, and now he's complaining where 4 years ago he's saying, great, we had the insurance. Now we lost by the insurance. It's just, it's a political campaign.
Sure.
For me, it's a sporting event. That's the way I look at it. It's also a serious event, but both sides play the game, and there's always going to be a winner. Now, if the Gomes campaign can make a compelling argument that 251 votes should have gone somewhere else, it's good for them if they can make that argument. Good for them and try it, but I think he's better off just going right to the general election and making his case, because maybe he can run as a martyr. I don't know.
All right. Well, now, listen, that's fair. Yeah, it's politics. It's sport. Lenny, thank you. The blog only at Bridgeport.com. Lenny Grimaldi. Great work this week, Lenny. We'll talk next week. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Okay.
Appreciate it. All right, there you go. So now the final certified margin, I think, by the Secretary of the State's office, 251 votes. But again, as Lenny said, You're going to get John Gomes and Joe Ganim duking it out again in the November ballot, you know? There may be other candidates on there, so it's a beauty of the system. Listen, you know, you work hard, you get more than one bite of the apple.